Hi, my name's TJ Myhill. I'm an attorney here in Atlanta, Georgia, and I do litigation, primarily business and IP litigation, and I understand we're here to talk about some various new law proposals and other issues relating to that, so I'll let the rest of the panel introduce themselves, and then we'll kick it off.
Thanks. I'm Jeff Termeshazen. I work here in Atlanta pretty much as Big Brother. The company I work for does communications internship. And I maintain and support those services and listen to your phone calls all day.
I'm Courtney Lytle. I am an attorney in Atlanta. I am mostly retired from active practice, but my practice is transactional. I teach at Emory Law School as an adjunct as well, and kind of have the academic side of this and the transactional side of it down. I don't litigate, which is distinctive for attorneys. And I do intellectual property law.
Hi, I'm Cara Mikus. I'm a litigation paralegal. I don't have the ask, but I work specifically with litigation issues, and so welcome.
Holy crap, you're all lawyers.
That's what I'm saying.
Well, that's why we need to.
And yet we're all more scared of you.
He's the guy that actually understands it.
That's also why I'm going to be quiet, because I've got lawyers here who can and will use everything against me, should that ever happen. That's what scares me. All right, so today we're talking about this horrible thing called COECA, which was actually a bill passed. Well, it never actually made it as a bill. It was killed in Senate, I think, or in committee.
Yeah.
It got out of committee, but never made it to Senate.
It didn't make it to a vote, which is the case for most legislation. Y'all remember the schoolhouse rock, I'm just a bill. You know, most of them don't make it that far. And COECA, in fact, didn't make it that far. They've rewritten it somewhat as the Protect IP Act, and they made a very long, painful acronym so they could have that. They started doing that a while ago. The CAN-SPAM Act was the first in the tech area, where Congress said, hey, we can be really clever. Let's make the word spell something. And now they've gotten really carried away with the Prevent Online Threats to Economic Creativity and Theft of Intellectual Property and for Other Purposes is the Protect IP Act.
Some poor staffer had to come up with that.
Some poor staffer, I think, got drunk and came up with that.
They probably went on IRC channel and said, how do we do this? And someone said, hey, we can do kiddie speak. And started passing it as bills.
So they have acronymed themselves into a new dimension, I think. But the So the current version, they've trashed COECA, and they're doing mostly the same thing with some changes as the Protect IP Act. The same senator from Oregon has placed a hold on the Protect IP Act. He appears to be the only one in Congress who feels strongly about it. That's kind of why it didn't make it out of committee, in my opinion, is that no one really cares a lot. The motion picture industry and, of course, the rights holders are interested in pushing some of these laws to think will help protect them and stem their hemorrhaging losses. One thing I had noticed, I'll just barge ahead here because that's what I do, in some of the discussion around this that's out on the internet, there are a couple comments that, oh, they've changed these words and I bet they don't even know what it means. Understand that is actually a safe bet. A lot of the tech folks who were commenting in various places on the that I was reading were saying that, oh, they may not even understand what these words mean. Please don't underestimate the uninformed level of Congress on many, many levels, and this is just one of them. Because, yeah, what it means to add and other devices to the definition of server, yeah, they have no clue. Someone told them that made it more comprehensive because other machines are now doing the same thing, and they said, oh, well, okay, if it's supposed to cover more than that, go ahead and put that in.
Yeah.
They don't understand. Most of them probably have not. Actually, I bet none of them have read it because it's not come to the floor yet, so it's still somewhere in committee now. They have not read it. Their staffers may have read it. And just please understand, senators and congressmen do not have any level of technical expertise. I am much more informed on technical level than they are, and I don't understand a lot of it either. So, and they know less than I do on these levels. I had sat in a committee where they were drafting potential legislation that fortunately died years and years ago, where they were debating whether a digital camera would count as a computer under their definition of computer, and none of them knew. Now, this is before everyone had digital cameras. I am that old. These weren't even congressmen. These were folks who were going to draft the laws for the congressmen. These were the academics who were experts in the field. And they defined computer as basically something that accepts output or accepts input and gives output. And that was pretty much the definition of computer. And then they were debating what that would cover. The consumer advocates in the room pointed out that it covered everything.
Including people.
There's not much commerce in people that's legal, so they weren't as worried about that. But it was, you know, the folks who were drafting it, and these guys were smarter than the congressmen, really were struggling on whether a digital camera would count as a computer. By their definition, a toaster would count as a computer, and this was going to kind of swallow a lot of consumer law. Fortunately, this one died years and years ago. But they don't understand it. So some of the arguments that are made that are being sent to the congressman explaining in minute detail why this language about server is so horrible, their eyes are going to gloss over and they're going to read right past it. To the extent, I mean, I'm making a big assumption that most folks in this room find this potential law, this bill, to be pretty hideous. If you're trying to be persuasive to that effect, the technical arguments are great for amongst yourselves. They're not going to do much if you're trying to make, you know, an argument with your senator, because he doesn't care and he doesn't understand it and he's too busy to go figure it out. You know, the computers work by magic. We turn them on, they work. When they don't work, there's a guy for that. You know, and so that's what you're dealing with when you're trying to be, because there's been this letter writing campaign stuff to your senators. If you're trying to add more to it, the technical stuff is not what to add. Exactly.
And I'm just wondering, if lobbyists are very, if they are active in trying to educate.
Well, as a general rule, lobbyists are the only reason they know anything. And lobbyist, if you're actually in the political system, is not an ugly word. We tend to say, ooh, lobbyist, evil, evil. No, really. No matter how intelligent or generally educated a senator or a congressman is, he or she can't possibly know everything that laws are drafted about. So they do have staffers that do work for them, but yeah, they rely on the lobbyists. And the only lobbyists who are effective over time, and the lobbyists are smart enough to want to work not just this week, but also next week, because a lot of different groups may have one big hot issue that is hot while this is up and then it goes away. The lobbyists need to eat next week too. So they need to make sure that their credibility is maintained. Most lobbyists who are successful give the congressman reliable information. Because if they feed them bullshit, the congressman's not going to go back to them again. And if their influence dies because they get known as the lobbyist who just feeds crap to people, they're not going to be able to feed their families for much longer. So they do, most of them, there are exceptions, and when it's Washington, you know. But most of them do try to give the congressman and the senators good information. And how active they are right now, it seems as if, just from my gleaning, looking at this in preparation for our talk today, the folks most active are the motion picture industry and the rights holders right now.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. How can they be the most active ones and not be lying to the folk about how they're going to do this?
I think they have to be lying. I mean, this act was brought about initially to stop the sale of counterfeit goods, and now it's turned into an entire copyright infringement act.
Well, they've changed. I mean, even COICA has been stopped and started over again. This one started as a Copyright Infringement Act. And laws often migrate and change purpose as they go. You can't get so many amendments before, you know, it completely changes its nature. But I don't know that they would have to be dishonest. They would have to disagree with you. But they don't have to be dishonest to say, look, what this does is allows the government to go in and just shut down the folks who are primarily dealing in either contraband goods or infringing materials. Now, the slippery slope argument we'll get to in a moment about, oh, well, they say, you know, only the sites that are primarily engaged in that activity, and they don't mean someone who just posted a YouTube thing that turned out to be infringing. And so they may say that, you know, the argument may be one that y'all don't find convincing because you're looking at saying, well, first you do that, and then who knows what's substantially involved in, or a site that's only doing this, you'll say, yeah, yeah, and then it'll just get used to smack down anyone they disapprove of. Whether that argument proves to be correct in the long run or not, it's not hard for the entertainment industry to say, look, we're losing tons of money that we should be paying taxes on and donating to your campaigns because people are posting all of these movies and all of this music and all of this, and oh, by the way, that trademark stuff that we're not talking about as much because we're the motion picture industry, we really care about copyrights. We have these concerns and we're losing this money and it's a loss to the country, it's a loss to the artists, and a lot of the artists are up there saying, yeah, we agree, we want money. And it's a very compelling argument if you're sitting in a senator's sort of seat. And it doesn't have to be disingenuous, because you can say, we want to shut down the pirate sites. And then, I mean, I printed this one out because it cracked me up. This was about the previous one, about Cuenca. And it was the article in Wired. I don't know how many of y'all saw that one. Oh, where is it? It's right here on the top second. Yeah. And it was really entertaining. Here we go. This is the front page of it. And it said Bill would give Justice Department power to shutter piracy sites worldwide, and it has this little, you know, knockoff on Pirate Bay going on here. And this was about Cuenca. And the Wired article is saying, as you might expect, how horrible it is. You know, all the motion picture industry has to do is say, look, they're saying this bill would shut down the pirate sites. Now they're saying it's a bad thing. Why should you listen to them? They're even saying, you know, they're. Big article was saying how horrible, you won't be able to get to Pirate Bay. That's not the kind of argument that's going to get you very far if you're trying to stop a piece of legislation. I'm sorry, you've been sitting behind it for forever. I just keep talking. So.
Questions. One, does it really make sense for the congressman to be educated by basically a group of people that want them to do a certain thing? Because it's not that they won't be disingenuous. Is that they just might leave off things about their position that could be detrimental to what they want to do. And also, why should the Justice Department get a worldwide ability to hold up insights like that? I mean, sure, Verizon is based in the U.S. and they are the .com registrar, but that doesn't mean that they should have, just because
well, that's one of the biggest problems with the law as is written. And they try to get around that by just saying, we're not going to actually go take those sites down, but we're just going to stop everybody who's in the U.S. from linking to them or advertising on them. I'm sure we're going to get into this a little bit as to all of the problems with the law. I mean, it's ridiculously overreaching, and it's not actually designed to prevent any of the things they're trying to prevent. Right. So even if you want to stop the file sharing or the, you know, whatever the MPAA or the RIAA is objecting to,
you say file sharing, they say infringement.
Right.
You know.
It's not really going to be accomplished by what they're trying to do in this act, and that's the problem. The senators have to be educated by someone, because you can't know everything. Whoever is being the most active lobby is going to be the one who's the most active educator. And here, the most active lobby on these issues is the RIAA and the MPAA.
Exactly.
And a number of other professional groups who are riding along on the coattails, but there's very few opposition lobbies. And the opposition lobbies, unfortunately, are making the arguments, like Courtney said, that, well, copyright's bad. Copyright is the law. Copyright is constitutional law in the United States. Mm-hmm. So you might disagree with it, but saying we shouldn't have copyright is not the way to argue against this particular copyright law.
And they shouldn't have to either, because there's a huge technical argument against it as well.
Absolutely.
It's just simply physically impossible to do.
Absolutely. And that's why the law is so incredibly overreaching. But just to answer the question, I really don't think the MPAA or the RIAA or any of the other industry groups are doing anything, whether intentional or unintentional, in omitting or lying or saying anything to the Congress people that isn't 100% accurate in their understanding. The difficulty is that nobody at the MPAA understands the technical aspects any better than the senators. They're there to lobby on the business ideas. They're there to say, we're losing money. We're losing money to this piracy. This piracy is against the law. We've got to stop this.
So why are they allowing the MPAA and RIAA to
like essentially indirectly lobbying to directly instead of having some non-business concern, like think tank.
Well, if the think tank cares enough to jump in, then the senators will listen to them as well. The way that it works on a practical level, both our state house here in Georgia and in Washington at the federal level, is the people who care the most are the ones who go down and either talk to the representatives or form groups and send the groups down, which means the lobbyists, the professional lobbyists who represent lots of different trade groups. And the lobbyists go and talk to the senators. And it really is a matter of the people who care the most either pay enough to get lobbyists organized and down there, or they, you know, start their letter writing campaigns and they do something so that the senators know they care. It's just, in a perfect world, sure, there would be independent groups that would educate the senators and the congressmen so they could vote more knowledgeably. And, you know, in a perfect world, I'd have a pony too. It's just not going to happen. So you have to look at the framework of how it actually works. And it's not as bad as people like to say it is. I mean, it's funny how lobbyist is often used as an ugly word, but it really is the only reason that the representatives and the senators know anything. And again, they don't lie. They just may disagree with you. And in this case, the most powerful lobbyists completely disagree with EFF's position on this statute. And so if you want to defeat a piece of legislation that's got well-respected lobbyists saying things like, we think stealing is bad, which there's not a real good argument against. Saying copyright is horrible has an intellectual resonance among a lot of digital rights groups. And I don't want to say it's not a very compelling argument. There's not a lot of value to it. But it's not going to play at all with a senator whose job is to legislate within the existing framework. And the existing framework is copyright is there. And saying, well, we think it's bad, so we don't think you should enforce it, isn't going to work.
You know these T-shirt dealers that are running around Dragon Con out there that say, stop bitching, start a revolution? It's kind of like you have to be the voice. If you're concerned with it, you be that voice. You need to take it to your local congressman, your local senator, and continue to.
But it's very time-consuming, and you have to find your way into the right offices and those sorts of things, and that's why most people don't do it. I mean, we're not saying you suck because you're not active. You know, it's but I mean, that's the reality of how the political process works, especially in something like this, where you can be pretty certain that no senator or congressman went to Washington with a strong opinion on this issue. It never made their radar. They didn't know it existed. So the first time they're going to hear of it is probably shortly before the vote, if it goes actually out onto the floor, which is not yet done. And that will be the first time to say, oh, well, I don't know. What is that? What do you mean they can do that, huh? And then someone will have to explain it using small words, and they'll say, oh, well, that sounds okay. And that's a problem with trying to defeat this act. The main thing I think that's defeated it so far is you've got that one guy in Oregon who's willing to place a hold on it, which means I care a lot and I hate it. And in the Senate, they have rules like that. One guy can hold stuff up like that. And as long as no one else feels strongly enough to pressure him to take the hold off of it, it may just die where it is, but you know, right now it's that one guy holding it up from a vote.
Yeah, I was just wondering, are there any good organizations to get involved in or to work with? I know of demandprogress.org and EFF.
I say EFF is a little group that you may or may not have heard of.
Both groups seem to be doing good, you know, more general purpose instead of trying to make real technical arguments, you know, trying to be more effective. Are there other organizations like that that would be good to, you know, throw support to that are likely to be effective?
EFF is the one I know best. I always recommend them.
I'm completely non-technical, so it's hard to say.
And they should be linking back and forth as well. So if you go to the EFF site, they should say other groups and things like that. And I mean, they're all working for the same purpose, so they've got no problem promoting each other.
There's a letter here that I had that EFF signed with a couple other groups, but for the most part, if you look at who's at least making the public statements about it and who's writing the letters that are published, you got a whole lot of folks in favor of it, and you know, EFF and another group or two who don't have as big a name as EFF as a general rule saying, no, wait, stop and think about some stuff. But you know, a lot of times they're tainted by that we hate copyright message, and it's not, you know.
Right, that's what I was wondering, which ones.
I don't know. I can't say that there's not one out there, but I can tell you with complete honesty, I don't know.
Right, and that's it. Most of the prevailing anti-bill lobby or you know the ones who are challenging these extensions of copyright are doing it on intellectual grounds, on academic grounds, talking about the interests of copyright and how it's going to be moved forward. There's not a lot of technical discussion happening because technical discussion, you know, let's face it, most people in every day-to-day business think computers are magic and the internet comes out of the plug in the wall, and if it stops coming out of the plug in the wall, someone comes to fix it for me.
Yeah.
So it's not
really
a,
all most of us know.
Yeah, it's really not a big part of what people are looking at on this issue, which is a problem because it creates laws like this, which even if the law itself had some sense, which it doesn't, it's not ever going to be an effective law. But that technological lobby isn't really a big part of the push. The other difficulty you have on the technology side is trying to shoehorn any of these technological discussions into the Copyright Act, which was written in 1976. We are so far beyond what was anticipated by anyone writing the Act that, you know, we're now trying to have to figure out how to work definitions that fit what's going on in the real world right now to the sort of author and creation language we had in the Act in 76.
Understand the Copyright Act, and it was drafted well before 76, just took them that long to actually enact it. There's like a decade where they already finished it, just took them that long to finish polishing it, so all of the copyrights that were expiring were being grandfathered in for almost 10 years. I mean, this thing was written in the 60s in large part, and it was written with the idea of people writing books, and books at that point meant paper, and people painting pictures and making sculptures, and, you know, movies were out, but, you know, color was kind of new. And so this was the reality of what they were writing the copyright law about. We've since added software into it, and it's a horrible fit. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't, every time you try to apply copyright law to software, it just creaks and screams because it doesn't match well. Best we got, but it doesn't work. And I did want to say before we leave this kind of topic about lobbying at it, there was, when it was COICA, there was a very persuasive letter written by a huge list of IP professors across the country. And that argument, I read that letter, and it was very persuasive, and one of the reasons it was persuasive is because it was signed, at least, by an awful lot of folks with a great academic reputation and a fair amount of gravitas behind them. Their argument was very persuasive, I thought, and it was the sort of argument that if a senator read that, well, let's be real, what did senators do before they became senators? They were lawyers. So this letter from a bunch of law professors was actually very compelling and was very straightforward, saying this is clear violation of a whole lot of things, including freedom of speech, First Amendment. It will clearly fail as soon as it's challenged. When you have 30-odd law professors saying that, you kind of notice. Now, I don't know if it was done intentionally to ditch all of that or if it was just one of those things that happens in Congress that works out well for a bill but was never done with intelligent design. Is that now, having changed it to a new act, you look at that letter and say, oh, well, this was the previous one, and I know there are changes. Oh, well, I'm not going to go back and figure out what the changes are. Did these guys rewrite the letter for this act? No? Oh, well, they must not mean it about this act. So there was...
This one must be okay.
Yeah, this one must be okay, because they're not arguing now. And so there's a difference looking at the level of dispute that was going on, and the people who were writing against it when it was COICA were a little more persuasive than what we've got so far. And this one's still new, and it still may die in committee again, but everyone was, to the extent there was going to be good rallying, did a fairly good job with COICA. And like I said, the professor's letter was one of the most compelling things I saw out there, and the arguments like that will resonate more with an academic is kind of closer was going to resonate with a senator than a hardcore technical argument that will just go zooming past. But that's not there this time. And they even have some lawyer who's calling himself a constitutional expert saying, oh, no, it's fine. Some of his points are absolutely valid, by the way. And he updated his letter from the previous act to the current act. So that, you know, it's just a matter of who's really doing their due diligence and keeping up with the fight.
So you've really got two issues here then. You've got the legal side, which is simply the challenge of, is this constitutional based on what's in the Constitution? When they get that sorted out, you've then got the problem of, can we actually do this technically?
Mm-hmm.
Because when I started seizing all the domains and things, Mozilla came up with a workaround for it in like a couple weeks, which means all that work that every time ICE goes in and seizes a domain, now it's like 2 days later and you can get right back to the site again. You know, so you're spending
tens of thousands, if not millions of dollars of manpower going and seizing these things. And because you've got co-hosting now, where you've got one system that may be hosting 10 or 20 or 50 different sites, they take the one down, but everyone else loses their site as well because the machine's been turned off. 2 days later, the guy that they were taking down is back up and running again, but the mom and pop shop, who is depending on that as like a primary source of income, is still out of business because the machine's still down.
And now that argument is one that can be explained with small enough words that the non-tech folks and the politicians understand it. And that one actually also resonates legally, because that there is a notion of not wanting to be not wanting to overreach. Now, there is no First Amendment protection for infringement. So infringing speech is not protected under the First Amendment, never has been. But if we say, well, look, other internet, commercial speech and internet speech does get protected, and if you can show that you are infringing other people's, not just their right to free speech, but also, their ability to make a living and be in perfectly honest commerce, because, you said you take down the one machine to get the one guy and 50 others are down. Well, look, you just said machine. Oh, we understand machine. And to get the one guy down, you have to take everyone else who's using that same one. That's actually an understandable and persuasive argument on both a practical and a legal standpoint, because that means, it is overreaching. There needs to be a more narrowly tailored way to do it. And those are, legal buzzwords that the senators and the representatives like to hear.
Senator's question over here.
You made a comment earlier about one of the compelling arguments, obviously, especially in this specific time frame, is loss of income and revenue and tax base and things like that. But it's a little disingenuous when you boil it down another layer, because the movie company is saying, hey, they didn't buy my $50 movie, so we didn't pay taxes on it. But the reality is that money went somewhere else in the system. They bought food with it. They bought a bike with it. Tax money did come in from that. It didn't vanish. They're not sitting it on their
NPA stuff don't care about you buying food.
The money is still being taxed. There is the capital is still moving. It is a zero-sum game. It's not like that money suddenly is being blocked up and put in a pile somewhere.
Well, that's a fairly persuasive argument in general. Remember that the MPAA is going to be approaching their California congressman and saying, hey, this money didn't come into California. Because if Johnny in Oregon downloads my movie, then we didn't get that money in California. He's buying a lot of groceries in Oregon. Yay. Where's our share? So, that's again the idea of having each state have an interest in these things and why you have so many people who do fall into line on some of these arguments. With you just look at the list of senators who approve of the bills and wonder what their connection to the bills might be. Now, some of them just want to stop online piracy.
Yeah.
Some of them, are really against the whole idea of illegal file sharing. But for the most part, there's always going to be an economic argument, because lobbyists make a salary. And senators, their staff makes a salary. There's got to be some economic incentive to go and make those arguments. I'm going to take days of my time to convince someone that this is what we ought to be doing. No one does that for free. So there's always going to be some business basis behind the interest going to the Senate and going to the House and going to the local state legislatures.
The other problem with that argument, although it's sound, and you're correct, that if you don't spend the money on this, you will spend it on something else, because no one saves money. The other side of that, though, is that they can turn that around very easily and say, well, yeah, and if you stole the groceries, you could spend it on my movie. Or, if you stole the groceries, you could buy a car. Stealing from me isn't justified by spending it somewhere else in the economy. It's still stealing from me, and that's still illegal, and we need to enforce that. And it's a hard argument to really prove, because although you're correct, the money will still get into the economy, the rights holders are also correct in that, it's technically stealing.
And they want their money.
They want their money. Mm-hmm. They're stealing from me. I don't have to prove that that's bad for the country. I just have to prove that's against the law, which is obvious, and this will help enforce the laws you've already passed.
And this is one of the real problems for the industries. The people who are lobbying are the MPAA, not the directors or the actors or the filmmakers. the people who are lobbying for musicians are the RIAA and not necessarily the musicians themselves.
Right.
And, of course, not everyone has the same mindset on it either, but there are plenty of ways to put your stuff out for free if you want to put your stuff out for free.
Yeah, some of the biggest movement in the music industry especially is doing a lot of the Creative Commons and share-alike mm-hmm. kind of promotion, and that's really where a lot of it is happening right now, but they're not lobbying. They're not that organized.
Right.
The people that are organized are the established.
And it's easy to demonize those entities because mm-hmm. it's not people. It's not the people who are creating. The RIAA doesn't create anything but lawsuits. And
sure.
that's what's got it so easy to hate the RIAA. I hate the RIAA.
Yeah, with justification, but understand that no one in Washington sees it that way.
Right.
You see them as evil, and I mean, with good reason. The senators just don't see it that way.
I have two questions. The first is, how far can you take that granularity thing and say, hey, I had this site that had a piece of content at the top and then a comment forum on the bottom? Well, the comments are all clearly protected speech, as well as arguably these people are commenting on that. Does that not make it a journalistic use of the content?
The problem with the journalistic use is that you're going to defend that by saying it's a fair use, and you defend that in court when someone sues you for using their content. That's one of the problems with this, is it eliminates the entire argument as to whether there's actually infringing comment.
Well, it doesn't eliminate it, just pushes it later, because
right.
this is an injunctive relief. So you have to go to the court. You have to prove that you're likely to win at trial, and that's not a low standard. You have to be able to prove that you are likely to be able to show infringement, you being the attorney general in this case, or the independent plaintiff. But so the plaintiff has to be able to show, in order to get the injunctive relief, and the injunctive relief is the takedown, the seizure of the domain name, to show that you have to pass muster to show that you would likely win at trial, and that you would be irreparably damaged if you were not. And sometimes they want to know that it would be bad for society as a whole, but usually they just look for, are you going to win, will you be damaged if we don't pull this down? And if they can show that, so they'd have to address a fair use thing, but not in the full tribunal. And then if you win at trial, then they'll put it back up, I guess. And, you know, that's 5 years and several
yeah.
millions of dollars from now. So
exactly.
So the injunctive relief really becomes the only meaningful relief. And there is at least the requirement to show a likelihood of success. And judges take that seriously, but it's not the same as having your day in court. But if it's just a use like that, it probably, at least at this point, if it's done honestly through the court system, that sort of site wouldn't be taken down, because what they're looking for is the ones who are hosting the
right.
actual, you know, file sharing. They want to take Pirate Bay down. They want to take down the ones who are letting you get to the pirated movies and the pirated music. That use, the courts probably wouldn't touch, because they don't care. The IRA doesn't care. If you have a little clip and you're commenting on it, no one cares. I mean, people are interested in listening to it, but the folks who own that content usually don't care. They think, oh, good, they're talking about me.
And my second question is, if they decide not to do this as a bill, but put it into, say, a Chinese IP treaty, how does that change the discussion? And does it still have to pass the same rules to be in a treaty? I mean, I know it has more power if it's a treaty, or arguably more power if it's a treaty.
I don't deal with treaties.
Treaties trump statutes, but a treaty still has to be approved by the Senate. Obama cannot just go and sign that treaty and make it law. Now understand that for all that traditionally the digital rights movement folks tend to like Democrats, understand that Obama is surrounded by trial lawyers, and I'm sorry if this sounds mean, but trial lawyers really love this kind of stuff. Anytime they see a chance for more litigation and more lawsuits, that's how they make their money. So the trial lawyers with whom President Obama has surrounded himself tend to like this. Ironically, the Bush administration was against stuff like this, and the Obama administration has so far signaled that they don't have any problem with it. And that's in large part because it's trial lawyers.
And
trial lawyers are very nice.
No, you're absolutely right. I'm going to make a good point on that. But the one thing that your point does go to, though, less the idea of the fair use defense that you may or may not ever get to raise, but more to the idea of the First Amendment protection on the rest of the site. If you've got a domain name which is hosting hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages of content, I mean, even if you're not dealing with other people's businesses under one server, you've got one page out of those hundreds that infringe. You've got 10 pages out of those hundreds that infringe. The idea that I can take the entire domain down that's a big First Amendment issue, and that's one of the arguments that's being made. And as far as trial, she's absolutely right. I mean, that's, to me, the best thing about this bill is that it starts off by saying that we're going to only use this against people who are primarily engaged in infringing or marketing themselves as being for infringing activity. That's fantastic for me. I can spend decades arguing about that in court, on either side. Who's
and
paying me
first? And he can bill by the hour while he does it.
And I will. So, but that's something that's never going to be a clear-cut issue.
Yeah.
And you know, somebody like the Pirate Bay, you can probably pretty clearly say they're promoting themselves
that's
as for infringing
they
activity.
Do. Come on. But, know, they picked a pirate flag as their emblem. They named themselves Pirate Bay. They're not subtle.
But your average.
Oh, well, look, they did have something legal. You know, I'm sure they stole that, too, you know.
But your average peer-to-peer or BitTorrent, you know, there's not going to be that necessarily that overt focus on infringing, even if it's 90% infringing materials that are going through there. If it's not as overt, and if this law is passed, the immediate reaction will be to not be very overt. And you're going to have a hard time meeting the stated standard. You're going to have to be proving that that's what the site is really there for, and not just that it's happening incidentally.
Like Napster's redoing.
Right, exactly. I'm sorry.
So it'll be hard to go after, say, Dropbox.
There's a lot of difficulty in going after many of the sites because of the pre-existing. Again, we're dealing with the Betamax law. Who in this room even remembers Betamax?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, crap. I'm at Dragon Con. Wait a minute. But okay, so you all remember Betamax.
It's still the bitter standard.
I agree. But the
marketing versus technology. Look which one won.
Absolutely. Yep. But the, you know, the idea of the substantially non-infringing uses that came out of that Betamax case. Well, there's plenty of non-infringing uses for peer-to-peer or BitTorrent protocols. They're just
and the fact that they put that language in there does two things. One is it makes his people very, very happy. They can buy boats. And the other thing it does is it gives the people who are in favor of the act the chance to say, well, no, we're not going to go after your site that's just using a small piece in, you know, what's likely a fair use and most of it's innocent commentary. So we've got all this great language about the internet site dedicated to infringing activities. The language goes on to say no significant use other than that engaging, enabling, or facilitating infringement, or is designed, operated, or marketed primarily as a means for engaging in infringement. So the drafters of the bill, the sponsors of the bill, can say with honesty, no, we're not after you, we're after the pirate sites.
Okay.
Because it's got to be dedicated to infringing or done primarily for that with nothing else significant. Now, what TJ just pointed out, though, is what that means, especially when you take into account that the Attorney General can bring this, and no one has to pay the Attorney General because he's already salaried.
Mm-hmm.
So the Attorney General's office can bring this, and all of the Attorney General office lawyers are the ones who will be bringing the cases against these sites. Well, they're paid by you. So they're already getting salaried off of taxpayer money, so they don't need the interest groups to do it. And then they're going to target, either intentionally or just because they think they're doing their job, any number of sites which then have to prove what this language means. And as TJ said, you know, he can argue either side of that very well in court as to whether or not it is. And senators are willing to say, oh, well, that's how the system works. Then the courts will adjudicate and make the decisions, which on a macro level is how our system works and is perfectly appropriate. It's the micro level where we all actually live where it's really problematic because none of us, well, unless there are people in here I don't know about, in which case, talk to me after, can afford to finance a lawsuit. The micro level, you can't defend against it.
Take something like YouTube. Their general content is just open. Other people own copyright. But the folks still go after them for even snippets of stuff that are up there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, wouldn't they fall under this over here?
No.
I mean, they say we won't do it, but how would YouTube be excluded from this other than we won't go after you?
Well, I think that what you have there is, if you're giving it just a fair reading rather than a suspicious reading, if I were just reading this, and, you know, I'm an academic, we do stuff like this, I would read this and say, well, no, I don't think YouTube would fall under this language, because the majority of what YouTube does is mindless, but not infringing, and the DMCA provisions seem to work well. When people object about an individual thing on YouTube, it's taken down, the site goes on, and most of what's up there is non-infringing, and we already have a vehicle in place to take down the independent infringing things, so there'd be no reason to even try to apply this against YouTube. And if it were tried to apply, YouTube isn't dedicated to infringing. It has plenty of significant uses other than that, and it's not designed with the primarily as a means for infringement. And that would be my just kind of fair reading, and if someone asked me or, you know, a more famous academic to give them an opinion on that, that's pretty much what we would say. But put it in the hands of a litigator, I think TJ will say that you could make the argument that YouTube would fall under it.
I could certainly make the argument. Would it be successful? I don't know, but I could certainly make the argument, and it will take quite a lot of time and quite a lot of resources to make that argument.
And the person making the argument, again, will be the Attorney General's office,
right,
which doesn't have to have their bill paid by the hour. So whoever they target. Now, YouTube could afford it.
Right, YouTube
can
pay for
the lawyers,
it.
And they'll get out of it. That YouTube's not going to be shut down by this. They have enough lawyers to see to it that this language doesn't apply to them. But the smaller sites,
yep.
I've got a question, kind of two-pronged. The first part is about what the Department of Justice bases its power to shut down international websites, which was done April 15th. There are some people have heard of it, Poker Stars. There are several different online poker sites that the Department of Justice went in and shut down internationally. And they based it on a law that got passed in 2006 that had been just kind of ignored for a while. And I'm wondering whether that law actually can stand on its own. I'd like to fight it. It's basically saying that the government has the right to tell you what you can and can't spend your money on. You can buy lottery tickets online, that's okay. But playing poker online is gambling, and that's not good. And betting on horses is okay. Can that fly? Is that constitutional to tell Americans what they can spend their money on?
Can we go to a casino right here, right now? Can I go buy a hooker? Can I buy some Coke? So the government tells us what we can and can't spend our money on all the time. That's exactly what it does.
And that's exactly what they're doing. Poker gambling is illegal, and therefore they can shut it down. Lottery tickets are legal gambling, subsidized gambling even, and so they're not shut down. The government can do that all the time. And in terms of the international one, I'll let TJ correct me where I'm wrong, because this is a jurisdictional issue, but as long as the site has contacts in the U.S., which is, say, it's doing business in the United States, it is submitting itself to our jurisdiction, the Justice Department can quite properly act against them.
Okay. The thing is, they base this law on what they call gambling. To me, going and buying a lottery ticket is completely gambling.
Yeah,
there's
but
nothing
the government
involved.
Is not.
You don't have to think. You just hand them your money and take your chances.
Well,
that's gambling.
Tax on people bad at math. But yeah.
Yeah. But poker, requires skill.
But that's it.
Doesn't matter.
Right
is
now.
That defendable?
Poker.
No.
Well, but poker is illegal, and lotto is not. And that's really what it comes down to.
So on a personal level or a logical level, yes, what you're saying is defensible and makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
What we're going to tell you is from a legal level, no, that's illegal. And that law has been passed.
Right. I mean, it's no different than saying that I can, you know, go to the corner and buy a fifth of gin, but I can't go buy a bag of pot, because one's legal and one's not, despite the fact
despite
that they're
the
essentially
fact.
The same.
Yeah.
You know, type
one
of product.
One doesn't make you sick the next day. You
right.
just make some grass and fried chicken.
So basically, the tack would have to be to legalize poker and say
right.
it's a game
correct.
Of skill.
Exactly.
And
they shut down
go
the website because it was engaged in illegal activity.
They only right. shut down the ones that they could get $3 billion from. All the little ones are still out there, and then going full.
Well, generally, it's considered appropriate to shut down the big ones and let the little ones either get big enough to kill or go away because they're afraid they're next. I mean, there's
right.
a certain amount of justice in saying, I'm taking out the really big ones. That puts all of y'all on notice, you're next. So if you don't want to be attacked by my big dog government, you'd better knock it off. And so that's not bad. And like I said, the difference between lottery and poker, morally, yeah, you can make that argument all day long, but the government's already decided it.
If I'm running a poker game, no one takes my house.
But it is illegal.
If the sheriff shows up
at your house and finds you running, yeah, they will.
They actually can.
Yeah. It's not eminent domain.
It's not eminent domain. It's criminal forfeiture.
Right.
Yeah. Someone will.
Yeah. By the way, if you are driving in your car with some happy chemicals in your pocket that you aren't supposed to have, according to the government, they can take your car. If someone in your car, that's not you, is riding in your car with stuff that they shouldn't have, they can take your car. They can take your house. If someone in your house has illegal things, they can take your house. And they do it occasionally. Usually not, but they can.
Mm-hmm.
And that's criminal forfeiture. And it's
where all those things at the sheriff's auctions come from.
Yeah. Those aren't just things that were confiscated in jails.
I guess I kind of got stuck on you when you made the comment about not being able to go down the street and purchase certain things that are illegal. Well, the internet is global. It'd be like saying the American government can arrest you for buying, say, for instance, marijuana when you're in Amsterdam. You're doing things online, but you're dealing with another part of the internet. You're not. How much of it's still dealing with U.S. law?
Well, that's one of the difficulties in any internet transaction. But the distinction is that when I go to Amsterdam, I'm in Amsterdam, and whatever I buy in Amsterdam. He's going to be using Amsterdam, stays in Amsterdam.
And he doesn't when he goes to Amsterdam, he doesn't take the U.S. laws with him.
Right.
When he's in Amsterdam, he's subject to the Amsterdam laws. He's not now subject to U.S. laws. When people come to the United States, they're subject to our laws by virtue of being here.
And that's the issue, is when I come in and buy something off the internet in my living room, I'm not in Amsterdam. I'm in my living room.
And subjected to the living room laws.
And the internet, which are extreme. And the internet, the site that I'm at has also come into my living room, and that arguably and has been so far been successfully argued that submits that internet site to the U.S. jurisdiction. You're doing business in the U.S., you're transacting sales in the U.S., therefore you're subject to the U.S. laws. Now, what happens when that's violated? Does that mean that the internet site can no longer sell, you know, if there's internet order marijuana, can they sell it to Amsterdam? Probably, because the government can keep them from accessing them in the U.S.
But the problem is that when they shut down the site, it shuts it down worldwide.
Well, right.
Yeah. So it does shut it down.
This,
in,
that's
yeah.
a, you know, this is that again is the problem with this type of law. What the?
Someone pulled the fire button.
Okay, well there you go then.
Yes, apparently. Exit the building.
Yeah.
No,
head out the door and see if you smell smoke.
I had a similar incident where I was running a game store and we ordered paintbrushes that were made in Italy, and the paintbrushes were made of horsehair, which when it came into the United States, it had to go through New York, New Jersey import, and it's illegal in the state of New Jersey to sell something made of horsehair. And so we had this whole long delay in because we were reselling it to somebody else.
Right.
It's not illegal in the state of Georgia to sell something made of horsehair, but it was in New Jersey where it got shipped through.
Right.
So we had this long thing, and luckily we didn't have to deal with it, but same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, the local law is applied to the local transactions.
If you read the fine print on the websites, if you go down to your commerce website and you read the fine print on the bottom, there'll be a whole long list of everybody can use this site unless you are in Texas, Alabama, Maine, you know, Austria,
right.
New Zealand, and, you know, Pocomoke, Pennsylvania.
Void where prohibited by law.
No one, you know, pays attention to it all.
If it's illegal to sell to you, we don't want to sell to you. And then, yeah, they may or may not get around to forgetting to sell to you, but you know.
Something you mentioned earlier about the U.S. laws being applied to folk overseas, is that whole Thailand sex trade thing then just an exception to that?
We're really against that. Well, that's the question: is are you what laws are you violating? Are you violating the laws of the country you're in? Are you
transacting some business that comes back that you take pictures. You know, there's all kinds of things that can still subject you to the U.S. laws. But generally, and arguably, you are violating U.S. law by purchasing those things. You're not doing anything with them.
Well, the next thing is, if you go over there and you have sex with someone you're not supposed to, it may be legal there, but it's illegal here.
Right.
But they prosecute you here, even though the deed was committed over there.
Right. And I think that they probably are ways they can. And I don't do a lot of criminal law. I'm a civil lawyer. I do business. But there are probably ways that they could find a way to prosecute you for buying what you buy in Amsterdam.
Right.
It's just not anybody's interest. No, I think that it's probably.
You think they can get you?
I just don't think that they would bother.
Well, they're actually the Amsterdam sales are actually fairly regulated.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, another question there is the fact that if you're paying by credit card, that transaction goes through the U.S. because your bank's in the U.S. Couldn't they say that makes you as liable under U.S. laws, same way that you buying through the internet makes them liable within the U.S.?
That's probably a good argument, too. I mean, again, I don't do a lot of this.
If you were physically located in the U.S., that would be a new argument. I haven't heard of going that far to make contacts. But you have to have jurisdiction over at least one half of the deal. There's in rem and in personam jurisdiction. Mm. I learned that in CP class. I still kind of remember it.
They're always written in italics.
That's like, oh, yeah, that's Latin. I remember those. But you have to have jurisdiction either over a person involved in the deal or a thing involved in the deal. If you're selling a piece of real estate that's in Georgia can you can be brought into Georgia law on that. If one of the people lives in Georgia, then they're subject to jurisdiction. If you have a transaction done by people in different states, well, you get federal jurisdiction. I remember CP class.
You're all
coming back. This is great. And but you know, if one of them is international, one of them's here, you can still bring them into the laws here because this transaction at least ostensibly occurred here. I think that saying that if my credit card company is here, that would be a stretch. But
one thing
stretch doesn't mean impossible.
On a federal level.
It doesn't mean impossible, but I think that it would not be done yet.
You may have an in rem argument over the funds.
Yeah.
That were used. The money's here. Criminal prosecution is a very odd thing.
Where is the money if it doesn't actually exist?
Yeah.
It's just my right to borrow against the bank there to give to them. Since the money doesn't exist, where is it?
And a bunch of civil lawyers and academics discussing criminal jurisdiction.
It gets really good. Y'all might just want to leave. We'll make ourselves amused all afternoon at this one.
I have plenty of amusement for TJ then, because he can argue both sides of this probably for me. Where do we have the burden of proof if we're having the DOJ take it in and just yank it right off before we ever look at it?
One of the problems with injunctive and these types of preliminary, pre-suit injunctions is that you almost never have the other side. There's going to be some instances where you're going to get notice and someone's going to be able to appear and someone's going to be able to make an argument. But both because of the ability to get an ex parte injunction in some respects, you don't have to have the other party there. And then even if you're not allowed to have ex parte, I can just serve you notice that says you've got to be here in 3 days. And, you've got to get an attorney and get yourself to wherever this suit is being brought.
Yahoo and Google can do that.
Yeah.
None of you can.
Exactly.
Yeah. It brings to mind that micro level when the RIA starts suing its customers. Sociologically, it goes back to we had Napster, but then when we started having, Apple Store, everything started going for a buck.
Well, understand, Napster was purely illegal. When I taught copyright class, all the kids wanted to talk about it. I'm like, well, I mean, there's a case now, we can read it, but legally Napster was not at all
completely illegal.
What they were doing was completely illegal, and there was no shading of that law.
But
it was just obvious they're violating the law. There's nothing academically interesting to it.
Academically not, but marketplace, business-wise.
Well, sure. That's fascinating.
It equalized that out.
Apple
to
said,
say,
I can do this in profit because when I do it, I'll do it with permission. Sure, from a business standpoint, that kind of thing revolutionized or is the first step in going towards that.
Yeah,
but from a legal standpoint,
it's because we can't, we can't keep up with software with something that was the wording from that copyright. It doesn't yet, we haven't made it apply. It won't.
I think one of the major problems with all of these acts, unless this one is now changed, but with COICA, it was very true that you're just guilty until they find you innocent, and you're done. Your website's shut down, and you're just done.
Well, COICA had the even worse provision of, here are the ones we've sued and taken the domain name of. Here are the ones we just want the domain name of because we think they're bad.
Yeah, the and blacklist. If you
shut them down, we'll give you some bonuses.
Yeah. We're paying a bounty on these sites.
That was atrocious. I mean, far from being, you know, illegal, it was just absolutely atrocious.
And that was one of the things that got some of the academics kind of like saying, they said what? Because my first thought was, oh, look, yeah, they're blacklisting someone. Yeah, right. And others just said, oh, my God, they actually did.
Yeah,
because people say that kind of stuff all the time, and it's seldom true because that's inappropriate in legislation. And so I was like, okay, well, what did they really do? Because they clearly didn't do that. Oh, no, they actually did that. Yeah, and so, you know, that one definitely was something that people could sink their teeth into and object to. That stuff's out now.
Yeah.
I want to know, what's the stance on, because they say that piracy is no longer effectively stealing because you aren't taking something as much as you are preventing them the ability to make money from something. Because, for instance, what's the difference between downloading it off the internet and, say, for instance, setting your VCR to or your DVR to record it? You're not paying for a copy, but you still possess a copy.
It's a matter of scale. There's the Copyright Act has always presumed a certain amount of copying. There's protection for home copying. You can take whatever you own and make a copy of it for your own use. If you want to take your, you know, music with you in the car, you can make a copy of any music you have and put it in your car.
And there's express provisions that allow that.
Right. You can take a copy, put it on your MP3 player.
Like with the music question, you bought a copy of that music and, say, for instance, you're ripping the files to your MP3 player.
Right.
You still paid for it at some point.
You did. And that's the thing, though. Generally, the idea was that if you had a copy of whatever piece of art and you wanted to make a copy of it for your friend, well, you would have to go buy the media to do that. You'd have to buy the tape or the VHS tape or the CD or the, you know, photocopier or whatever you were going to use to make a copy. Then you would have to take the time to make a copy, and then the copy itself would be somewhat degraded. And chances are you wouldn't do that for more than two or three people. You might make a copy of the album you bought for your really good friend, but that'd be as far as it's going to go. Now, the challenge is that you buy a copy, and everybody at Dragon Con can get a perfectly clean digital copy of that work. And they can then send it on to everybody they know, and everybody they know, and everybody they know, and everybody they know.
And people they don't even know. They just put it up and say, here, anyone on the internet who happens to stumble across here can have it. It's not even a matter of, I got this really cool album, which is pressed vinyl, is very flat. There were needles that went around it. so I bought this really cool album. I'll make a copy for my friends. Well, we would know this. I don't have many friends. So there wouldn't be that many copies. One, I have a friend. so, you know, it's limited. But the recording industry just started losing its collective mind when they realized all I have to do is post it, and people I've never heard of can get it. And as TJ was pointing out, this was a huge thing that, again, made the record companies just scream in pain, was when they realized that when I'm posting this, or even if I'm just giving the copies to my friends, they're just as good as the one I bought. Because right. Back in the days when you bought albums, if your friend burned you a copy, we made you a tape. If your friend made you a tape of that album and you really liked it, well, first off, the cassette tape's going to rip out pretty quick and leave it in the car for an hour and it's dead. But if you really liked it, you'd go buy your own album. But with the MP3s, why would you buy the CD if you've got the digital version? And they're perfect. They're not degraded. I mean, it used to be a big deal. The Grateful Dead was one of the early Sharon Shara-like bands. They always said, go ahead, set up your recording, but please do it in this little space that we've given you because we don't want the damn antennas throughout the audience. They're annoying. And really, this is where the best sound is going to be. So they had a place that you could set up your recording equipment and record their concerts. They were fine with it. And there was quite a market in bootleg tapes. We called them bootleg tapes, but they were actually legal from the Grateful Dead because they said, sure, go nuts, do what you want. Their album sales didn't suffer. People still came to their concerts. They had plenty of money. but they allowed these tapes. But the tapes, you know, it's what generation bootleg is. And if you found, you know, a second generation, oh my God, or a third or fourth generation bootleg from one of the shows you really liked, you'd shell out bucks for it. Because by the time you got many generations out, they were crap. I mean, it sounded out of the recorder the way it had sounded when you were listening to it, maybe. But somewhat out of focus. But so now that multiple generational copies are just as good, is scary for them. Because there's no longer, it's like, oh, and I loved that so much, I'm going to go buy the album. Well, yeah, I've got the album.
Well, I got a thing there, because you guys are talking about actually providing the content. But the folk rear were going after the folk who are simply bringing it down.
Right.
Right.
Which is a completely different ball of wax. I mean, if you're just downloading, okay, you're naughty, but it goes back to the question of you're simply copying off of there. You're not necessarily providing it, you know, you're not providing it to others.
Right.
But the real we're going over the folk who are simply downloading it for their own use and not actually providing it to others.
Well, they're using that to make a point. They're trying to scare people into not doing it, is why they're bringing those lawsuits.
Well, I don't know. How many people in here have heard of the Kaminsky attack? Okay, all the techno geeks here. Yeah. The Kaminsky attack came out a couple of years ago, and basically it's a very simple attack on the DNS system, which is how all the server, how all your machines talk to each other on the network is using DNS. Think of it as the yellow pages for the network. When you go to Google, you don't actually go to Google, it actually looks it up in DNS, it gets an IP address, and then uses the IP address to go there. Think of it as like looking up my name in the phone book, get my phone number, call me. Well, the Kaminsky attack allowed someone to poison a DNS resolver such that instead of when you went to Courtney's site and going to Courtney, it went to this fine gentleman here who stole all your stuff.
Oh my God, it was you.
Okay. So it was a vulnerability in the DNS system. So in order to compensate for that, to protect people from giving you false information, they're having to implement a technology called DNSSEC or DNS Secure. And the way DNS Secure works is using certificates, you cryptographically sign your DNS records. And that allows you to, when I go to a DNS server and I say, I'd like Courtney's site, please, and it gives me the information back, I can verify the signature and say, yes, that was signed by Courtney's DNS. I know this is true, and he can't give me false information. That's what we're having to do. We have to implement this. It's in the process of being implemented. Well, the IP Protection Act that they're talking about, the mechanism that the government has chosen to solve this problem is to redirect DNS so that you can't go to the site you're supposed to do. Well, that's effectively doing this very attack of lying to DNS, which breaks DNSSEC and puts us back in the Stone Age, essentially would kill the network as we know it. So there are quite a number of people who were involved in this research, especially at Georgia Tech, with this Kaminsky attack when it came out. And so they're really up at arms. They are, in fact, publishing papers and writing opinions and sending them to congressmen. Because, in effect, the non-technical explanation of this, a man in New Hampshire robs a bank with a car. He got gas from Quick Trip. So they're going to ban gas from all the Quick Trips to stop bank robbery. Yeah, on the face of it, you go, well, that's kind of stupid. By the way, so they ban DNS. Now, what that means is when you go to Courtney's site, it goes to some government site that says, we've taken down the site. Fine. In my cache, since I went to it 10 minutes ago, which you can, by the way, dump and look at on the screen, there's her IP address. So I simply take that and go on my host file and put the IP address in and go directly to her site anyway. It did not stop me. I just went over to the Shell station and got gas. Okay.
Of course, that will not stop any of y'all, but it will stop the rest of the world.
Well, actually, another thing you can do. The only reason DNS works the way it does is because we basically all agreed to use AT&T's phone book. Well, my good friend Daniel here will come out with his own personal phone book, hosted out of, say, the Cayman Islands, where they can't touch him, or Argentina, someplace fun like that. And we'll just simply point our resolvers there.
Okay, and they'll use. You mean you guys?
Yeah, well, no. I mean.
Never going to do that.
Oh, well, actually. Yeah, a free tool will come out.
I hang out with you.
Okay, you know how you root your phone? You know, those of you who want to jailbreak your phone, you go, I have a. You go to this website and you say, please, oh, from your phone, you say, please root my phone. It says, congratulations, your phone's been rooted. And you're done. I mean, they will build tools to do this. This is ridiculous, the mechanism they chose to do it. Now, we're not, none of us in the IT field are saying, well, this is really bad that they're trying to stop us from stealing stuff. No, we totally agree. You shouldn't steal stuff. It's not ours. Don't mess with it. But the mechanism the government has chose to do it is absolutely brain damaged.
Right. Well, your challenge is that makes perfect sense, and the way you explain it does make sense, much more than some of the more technical stuff does for those of us who don't speak tech. The challenge is getting that clear an indication of it to the senators, because what they get is either overly technical and they don't understand a word of it, or it's tainted with the, oh, you can't take away my right to go to Pirate Bay, which they just disregard because people whining about not being able to steal.
Right.
So getting that message to them in an intelligible fashion, like you just provided it, because I followed that.
Send that man to Congress,
because that's what they're not getting. And that argument would actually be persuasive, saying, look, what you're trying to do technically isn't going to work, and this is why. They'll listen to that if they hear it.
Well, for those of you who are in, you know, somebody asked about where we can go to fight this and do this. Well, EFF is a good place.
Mm-hmm.
Well, also, if you go do a Google search on Dan Kaminsky, while it still works before the government messes with it, he and other researchers are, in fact, doing exactly that. So you can add your voice to that argument, too.
Sure.
It is
that's
possible.
And that's it, really, that's the biggest problem that I have with both COECA and the Protect IP is not... There's a lot of people out there saying that they're basically trying to use a nuclear warhead where what you want is a sniper rifle.
Yes.
And that's a terrible analogy, because the fact is a nuclear warhead would work. And here you've got, not only do we already have all the sniper rifles, not only could we actually use copyright law to shut down all of the actual infringers, mm-hmm. well, that's time consuming and it's costly and it's a lot easier to just make this one shot. The nuclear warhead analogy suggests that it would be effective,
right.
Very effective. And in fact, nothing about this law would be at all effective in shutting down technical piracy. Because even if it was absolutely successful in all the ways he's explained why it won't be, do you think the Pirate Bay wouldn't just show up next week with some other site? And when they shut that one down, they're not going to show up next week with another site?
It's like stomping roaches.
You know, I mean,
electricity
illegal. I'm pretty sure Pirate Bay can afford $100 for domain name registration every now and again.
Yeah,
so.
Thanks. Another thing, though, in terms of something practical that can help is support for this Oregon senator who's currently holding it up. I don't know if any of you guys are from Oregon, but people live there, I understand. If a lot of his constituents were to sign something saying, thank you, keep this up. If any of a number of businesses that were to contribute to his campaign were to say, oh, remember me, that check you got last election cycle? I really like what you're doing. Well, that can, you know, kind of strengthen his resolve to stand up to whatever pressure he's going to face politically to remove the hold from it. Because he's right now stopping it very effectively. But at some point, he may get talked into letting it go by, you know, fellow senators say, look, I understand you've made your point, but look, I'm from California. The motion picture guys are really breathing down my neck. Why don't we, look, you want this other thing. Look, I'll help you out with that. You help me out with this. You've made your point. Let's just let it get vote. Anyway, not even you must vote for it, but just release your hold so the Senate can vote. Well, you know, how can you object to that? It's so reasonable. But anything that might strengthen his resolve to keep the hold on it might be effective. And again, it's votes and money that senators care about. So if folks from Oregon told him how fabulous they thought he was, or, you know, something along those lines, that might help. Or even non-constituents saying, gosh, I've heard of you now. Your name is getting known amongst a whole lot of people who like to vote, and we think you're fabulous.
Or go to your own senator and tell them to support this guy.
Yep.
That too.
Now,
go and say, hey, he's doing right. But then you're going to, again, at that point, you've got to give your senator some sort of reason that, or don't. Just say, hey, what he's doing is noble, and your constituents support him. Sometimes that's enough. Or make, you know, if you can make the argument Keith just made, oh my God, that would be great, but that's hard to do and hard to make someone listen to. Just don't start, just don't do the, you know, freedom of speech, which sounds like you're saying everybody should be allowed to steal argument, because no senator's going to listen to that. And they're going to say, oh, one of them. and just quit listening. And even if you're right, they're not going to listen. And so sometimes you have to be aware of the audience to whom you're speaking.
I don't know if this is the same in Oregon as it is in Georgia, but if you're going through lobbyists, great, because they'll take it for you. But if you're signing like an online petition, in Georgia at least, you get 10,000 votes, that counts as one entry for them because they got it from one source. So the petitions are nice and whatnot, but contact them directly, at least in Georgia. Because if five of you contact them directly, they'll count it as five people going, hey, we want this changed. If you get 10,000 versus an online petition, they'll count it as one. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
And if you can talk to one, I mean, if you call, someone answers the phone usually. I mean, senators still are elected, and they are always running for re-election. And their staffers know that they are always running for re-election. If you go to Washington and want a tour, call your senator. He'll hook you up. That's what they do. They try to keep their constituents, big and small, happy. It's how they get re-elected. So if you, you know, all of you have some representatives, if you call them, you'll talk to one of their staffers. You may be telling this staffer for the first time that this even exists and that someone at home cares about it. And if you have told him that, then the first time the senator says, okay, who knows about this thing, he'll say, oh yeah, someone from our district called about that and was very polite, very knowledgeable, didn't use words I don't know, didn't seem to be one of those wackos who wants to be able to steal stuff, and said that it was a really, yeah, that this act was bad, that the senator from Oregon had it right. Well, that may be the only thing the senator hears about. They work with imperfect information, and at least most of them do the best they can. Some of them don't. They're just crooked. But most of them are doing the best they can, and when they don't understand this, you know, that may be all they hear.
So just as an aside, Firefox browser supports an add-on that redirects seized domains.
Yep.
The government,
yeah. So even idiot-proof, so even idiots like me could do that.
My mom could do it.
Ooh.
The government asked them to remove it, and Mozilla said no. So.
One last question.
So jurisdictionally, if two people outside of the United States wanted to do business in something that wasn't legal in the United States, and they're shipping things back and forth, and those packages go through the United States just because ports, whatever, shipping routes take them through. Is the U.S. going to search those things at the border and stop those people from having their business cross into, through, and then out of our border again?
In rim jurisdiction?
If they're going to, I mean,
if they're going to be the same for packets as goods.
Yeah. If they're offloaded and customs opens the box, they're staying in customs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened to my horse.
And
yeah, if
packets,
it's illegal
I assume,
here, you cannot
would be
ship it
subject
here.
To the same thing. If you have any route that you use a single router in the United States that came in our borders and left our borders.
If no one heard it, if no one heard the tree fall, it may not have made a noise.
Right.
I don't think they've gone
same
that far
same through the UPS
yet.
Package.
Well, no, but then there's a physical piece of contraband within our borders. That's different than some ones and zeros that went by and no one knew it.
The difference is that Customs has the right to open any packages that are sitting in Customs. No one's necessarily going to be opening, you know, all the digital information.
Yeah, they do. That's why you encrypt your data.
But, well, I mean, they can. And I think that jurisdictionally, if you... Again, I don't do criminal jurisdiction, but I think that an argument could be made at the very least that if you've sent something criminal through U.S. servers or through U.S. routers, then you have committed a crime in the U.S. because the copyright law is explicit that a copy in a machine's memory is a copy.
But
so,
if it goes through a router, is there a copy made in the memory?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's also the sheer numbers, right? It's and what they're looking for.
Right.
If you send one package, they're probably not going to catch it because there's billions of packets that go through a single router. Its cache is only like 25 seconds, typically, the really big routers. They don't hold a lot of cache. But it's a sheer number. But if you're sending thousands of copies of something, they're going to notice. I mean, it's just how Comcast figures stuff out, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it is. It's the sheer numbers game.
I mean, that can't really bug to me about the
they can.
Loaded up software that creates a...
Yeah, I mean, I used to work for an ISP, and absolutely, every once in a while, they would come in and they'd say, we want your logs of all the traffic from the 24th of November to the December 1st, and we would hand them over to them. So they absolutely do.
Yeah.
You know, I can't make the subject to U.S.
It's a piece of airplanes that applies to information as well.
Yeah. By the way, for those of you who don't know, when we talk about logging information, imagine you just downloaded, 50 DVDs off the net at 4 gigs apiece, and you're talking, terabytes of data here. Well, whatever the math is, it's been a long weekend. I'm not going to store the entire internet that you just downloaded on my local hard drive for 5 years in case somebody comes and asks me for the data. We can't store all those packets. So they don't actually get cached anywhere. However, we do a thing called net flows. Think of it as this way. When you go to the phone company and there's a criminal investigation, and they're going to, I'll pick on my friend Dan here, and they say, we think Dan did something bad. We want his phone records. Well, they don't just go in and pull all your phone conversations, digital copies of your phone conversations, hand them to the police. They can't store all that data. But they can give him the call record that says he received a call at 3:13 in the morning from this phone number from a throwaway cell. They can get that. Well, that's what net flows are. They're the think of it as the your phone bill. It says you called here, it called back, you called on this port. That information is evidence. That we do keep. We keep it for a year. So, yes, but no. I can't tell you what's in the packets. I can tell you that the manner in which you did it looked a little fishy, but I can't tell you what's in the packets.
And there's a very nice little thing called Tor that'll help you get around that.
Absolutely. EDSF, once again.
Yeah, every security guy you talk to, because I used to work with Keith side by side, every security guy you talk to, and I'm sure everyone on this panel will agree with me, that every email you ever send should really have a key signature. It should be signed and encrypted. It doesn't really matter. I mean, if you knew how the email bounces around really bad, anyone can slurp that down and look what you're sending.
Actually, what I would tell you is, if you don't want people to hear it, don't put it in writing.
Yeah.
And email
and don't
is
send
writing.
It.
If you don't want someone to later be able to see what you're saying, don't say it that way.
Yeah.
Because someone's got that email. It's discoverable in any number of ways. And smart gentlemen like this have assured me many times that even though I may never be able to retrieve that document I lost, smarter people can. There is no erasing without, like, a steamroller across my computer, and then only if it never talked to anyone else.
Mm. Yeah, and personally, I would actually disagree with him, but that's just because I don't want to have to hire somebody to read your emails when I get them through Discovery, because I will get your emails through Discovery,
yeah.
And I will read all your emails.
And he'll get the guys who can get them even after they're deleted.
Right. But I'd rather not do that, so don't encrypt anything and don't delete anything and put all your incriminating stuff in writing.
Out there in the open.
Yeah.
Cool. Sorry, go ahead.
I guess what you'd ask them to do is only put the incriminating stuff in writing and leave the rest of the crap out. So
that's
what,
yes,
stuff,
yes.
Easier for
please,
them.
Anything that will make your defense easier against me, leave that out of the emails.
Just so we can swing this to the geeky side, what would you do as the expert on the technical side to achieve the ends? Because my way of tackling something, if I don't like a law, I find a way to either say it violates the Constitution, whatever, or I've got a better solution. And usually the better solution will make that bad solution go away. Is there a way to prevent the piracy and stuff that would make this really terrible legislation go away?
Just don't do it.
Well,
that's,
I mean,
it. Because technically they can get around everything. Like they said with Mozilla stuff. As soon as you change the domain name, someone brings out a thing that gives you the domain back again. There's no technical way to physically remove every copy because there's no central point for it. They'd have to have direct control over every machine in the world to make sure that no copy ever resided on any hard drive anywhere, on any computer, on any iPad, on any mobile device.
Just
technically, it's just not possible.
A perfect example is that they've been telling girls this over and over again. do not take pictures, inappropriate pictures of yourself, and post it or send it to anyone, because it will be on the internet forever. They cannot pull them all. They cannot do it. It will scatter around so fast to so many people.
Lawyers do Google.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah.
Keith,
I mean,
what was the thing with the guy sent? I think it was the Sony hack, where he sent it out, and the judge said, one of your conditions is you have to go get that stuff back. Someone came and explained to them, that's not going to happen. And the judge actually went and changed that and said, all right, I've been informed, this is just no way this is going to happen. So we're going to drop that clause from this thing over here.
Yeah,
because there's no way, we now understand that there's no way you can go and retrieve everything that's been sent out.
Well, even old school copyright, one of the remedies for copyright is the recall of the infringing products. Well, send a letter to everyone who's ever bought a book from me and say, please send the book back? How many do you think I actually even get back? Yeah. But at least that is a tangible thing. There's one book, and I can go get it, arguably. The technology aspects are completely gone. So,
yeah, and that's the big disconnect between the legal and the technical, is the legal wants to be able to do X, and there's just no way to do it.
Right. Well, if you notice, both I do this, and it cracks me up that TJ said the same thing. We like to take the law back to where it made sense, and so we're talking about the technical and digital, and we'll say, you know, when it was a book, a tangible book, this would be the way it was done, and that's how we're still thinking, because the law worked then.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's like, well, so now it's different, but let's talk about books, because that makes sense, and we really like talking about books. But all lawyers will at some point always do that. We'll say, okay, this is when it worked. And we'll talk about books. And we'll talk about tangible things because it was easier then. And we'll do it in criminal law. We'll do it in anything we're talking about. We'll take it back to the simpler case because it was simpler.
Yeah, I think you're talking about the recent Sony case with the console hacking.
Yep.
Yeah.
Rootkicks and jailbreaking of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Essentially, what happened is he figured out how you could load your own code on the Sony PlayStation,
which made Sony very unhappy.
Yeah, and the idea being is, hey, I bought the hardware, it's mine, I can do what I want with it. And
initially had it where you could do
it. It created a problem. Well, he put out the information on the network. Now, I haven't read the case to see, I haven't seen this where he's talking about where the guy retracted the judgment and saying he had to pull it back, but once you post that on the internet, it is there forever. I get this all the time from students where they say, I've got this page and it's been indexed by Google. Could you take the page down, please, while I was at town? I take their page down at tech. There's copies everywhere. You probably got one in your cache and your hard drive. There's no taking it back.
The Internet Archive.
Yeah.
Well, I think I got to pull this to a close, right? So thank you for the panelists.
Thank you.